The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, not known as Big Balls. I am, however, the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe and the greatest living American writer. You can find our website at www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and much more. We're going to talk about a couple of movies and about a very popular TV show this week. I'm going to speak with Pablo Gallaga about Companion, which is a very fun sci-fi horror comedy, basically about sex robots, for lack of a better description. And that is in theaters now. I love that movie. I'm also going to talk about the hot water cooler show in America of the moment. That is Severance, of course. Season 2 has begun airing on Apple TV and it is twisty and turny and just as weird, if not weirder, than season 1. But first, Stephen Garrett will be here. We're going to talk about I'm Still Here, which is a terrific Brazilian film about political prisoners and disappearing people in Brazil in the 1970s. It has vaulted into the Oscar conversation in a number of categories, well-deservedly, I say, and so does Stephen. And after this brief interlude, he will be here to talk to me about I'm Still Here.
Você tá bem, mãe? Tô, filho.
É desenho, pode ser desenho.
3, 2, 1.
One of the surprises of the current Oscar season has been the ascendancy of I'm Still Here, which is a Brazilian film that, frankly, I hadn't heard about at all until 3 weeks ago when it got the Oscar nomination and when Fernanda Torres got her nomination for Best Actress. And I was like, well, what is this movie? Where did this movie come from? And I have now seen it and I have reviewed it for Book and Film Globe and I have hired our non-Brazilian film critic, Stephen Garrett, to talk with me about it. Hello, Stephen.
I'm trying to think of like a Portuguese phrase. Disculpe. I know thank you and excuse me. Obrigado and disculpe. And I don't know which is which.
I don't speak Portuguese. Well, obrigado for being with us today. Before we start talking about this film, we have to offer a disclaimer that Stephen, I don't know if you all are aware of this or not, but Stephen, in addition to being America's leading critic of film, also works in the film industry. You have a company that you edit trailers.
I do. I produce and edit trailers. I have a marketing company, which also has a print division. So we have somebody who's fantastic who does posters as well.
So there's a reason why you don't review everything for us, because sometimes you actually are a paid client of the films that we discuss. And I'm Still Here is one of those films, I take it.
Right. Yes. If I am a paid vendor for one of these distributors, then I make sure not to talk. I may write about a film coming out of a festival before it's been picked up.
Before you've been hired.
Before I've been hired.
Yeah. That's fair. I guess the real question, though, Stephen, is do you take money from USAID?
Not anymore. Oh, boy, that gravy train's over. Boy, that was a good run, though.
Time to pay that $47 million back, Stephen.
MAGA found us out.
You've been rooted out. But regardless, we do have you here. But I still thought you would be a good person to talk to about I'm Still Here, even though you are heavily compromised. First of all, let's be clear. Anyone who doesn't like this movie, it has a heart of a rock. You know, it's basically a beautiful film about the enduring quality of family in the face of political repression.
And upheaval, yeah, for sure.
And upheaval, right. So it takes place in Brazil in the early 1970s, and then later as well. But like the majority of the film takes place in the early 1970s, and there's this sort of, I guess, this left-wing family in Rio, you know, this sort of a political partridge family. I mean, there's just these beautiful kids running around, going to the beach, eating ice cream, smoking weed, listening to Caetano Veloso, having a blast, right? And the greatest parents ever, right? Like the father is, he's an engineer. He used to be a liberal congressman, and he had to flee when a right-wing military junta took over.
Right. And this is all true, a true story. He's a real person.
It's a true story. It's a true story and based on a novel by one of kids who was boyhood friends with Walter Salles, who is the guy who made the movie. So Walter Salles is one of those kids playing soccer in the street.
Yeah.
And what I love about this movie, it's a great film in a lot of ways, but what I love about it is that a lot of it's told, a lot of sort of the vibe of the 70s is relayed through like old pictures and like home movie footage.
Very evocative.
And it has this like, it has the quality of actual memory. Mm. And the reason for that is because Walter Salles actually remembers it.
Mm. Right.
And he's an extremely gifted filmmaker. He made the adaptation of The Motorcycle Diaries and other movies.
Most notably Central Station, which dates back to 1998. And that starred the mother of Fernanda Torres, Fernanda Montenegro, who was Oscar nominated.
It's not the mother of Fernanda Torres. It is the person who plays Fernanda Torres's character as an old woman.
Well, in this movie, for sure. But also it is, mother and daughter, like in real life. Oh.
The actual mother. I did not know that.
The actual mother, yeah.
No wonder they look so much alike.
It's great casting. Yeah. It's great casting.
They're also both just tremendous actresses. And Fernanda Torres is surprisingly currently now that Sofia Carla Gascon has tweeted themselves out of existence, is probably the favorite to win Best Actress.
I don't know. Demi Moore's kind of holding
maybe
her own,
Demi
so,
Moore.
But she's definitely... She's now in the number two position for sure.
So here's the thing. Like, this is a movie, it's a political movie, right? And I feel like its political importance is probably more strongly felt in Brazil, which is a country that's still trying to come to terms with the fact that it was ruled by a right-wing military dictatorship for a while.
Right. And this movie, incidentally, is a huge hit in Brazil. It's like a big monster hit.
I mean, if you love Brazil, you're going to love this movie. This movie doesn't make the government look good, but it makes Brazil look like a freaking blast, man.
Yeah. And sorry, just to give a temporal picture of the movie, it starts in 1970 in Rio de Janeiro, and then they move to, where do they move?
They move to Sao Paulo.
Sao Paulo, that's right. And that's where the story then picks up in 94. And then
96,
again,
yeah.
Or 90, yeah.
And then again, close to the present day, like 2018, something like that.
You see
the furniture change, you see, and every era looks very period accurate. And I love the house that the apartment they live in 1971. It's very shabby chic.
Oh, it's great.
And they're just all like, they have a foosball table and they're like listening to records and they're all like, and they're just, the older kids are smoking weed and the vibe, just the vibe. And what I love is that, the father disappears, but they don't disappear him at the beginning. Like they give you get 30 or 40 minutes with him. So you really feel the loss. You feel what the loss must have been like for these kids to lose their awesome dad.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason I brought up the temporal, kind of extension of the movie, that it is this kind of sweeping look at 50 years, 50 plus years in the life of this family is, it kind of explains the title. I'm Still Here is his presence lingers. He is a disappeared person, one of hundreds of thousands, right? In Brazil.
20,000.
Hundreds of thousands. Okay, 20,000.
But it affected hundreds of thousands of people.
It did.
Well, I'm Still Here refers to him and it also refers to the family.
Yeah.
Like the family, like even though he is gone and, his memory will linger and the family, it didn't break them, They endured lots of difficulty and tragedy, but they're still a large, loving family that refuses to give in to the fascists, essentially.
That's right. And part of the struggle over those years is to get the government to admit that this happened and to get a death certificate for the father, because he technically just disappeared. They don't know what happened to him. Maybe he was kidnapped. Maybe he wasn't. Maybe he was tortured. We don't know. Maybe he died. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't us.
And then by the 90s, when democracy had been restored to Brazil, the government was like, oops. The thing is, like, a lot of the movie is sort of like exists, you're in a domestic sphere. There is like a harrowing 20-minute sequence in the middle where Fernanda Torres's character and one of her daughters are kidnapped essentially by the government and taken to a black box facility and hoods placed over their heads and subjected to questioning, if not quite torture. But you see some torture sort of ongoing around them, and you get a little glimpse of the horror that was actually happening. And I pointed this out in my review, Stephen. This sort of Latin American missing person movie was a genre in the 80s.
Oh, very.
You had them. You had Missing, The Official Story, both of which were very critically acclaimed and award-nominated films in their time. And also the Mexican documentary director Lourdes Portillo made an Oscar-nominated movie about the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo in Argentina. That was from the 1970s. But this was the kind of thing that, was on the mind of a liberal cinematic community right back in the day. And you haven't seen the subject matter in a movie in a while, which may be one of the reasons why it feels fresh to contemporary audiences. And also you hadn't seen it about Brazil.
No, it's true. And it's funny because you think, cinematically, one of the biggest hits out of Brazil, in the 70s was this movie, Dona Flor and Her Two Husbands, if you remember, with Sonia Braga. It was the first movie that it's kind of like a Jules and Jim, but like a magical realist sort of a twist.
Right.
And that was kind of the vibe of Brazilian movies while this, kind of political repression was happening. Yeah. And then fast forward to the early 80s and you have a movie like Kiss of the Spider Woman, which I think is Argentina. But the Spider Woman is Sonia Braga. I mean, it's definitely by the 80s. Independent films and international films are being much more overt about talking about the political repression and dealing with it and processing it.
Right. But I feel like as someone, who was an amateur Latin Americanist back in the day, you heard a lot more about the junta in Argentina and of the kind of crimes of General Pinochet in Chile and not as much about the regime that was running Brazil back in the Brazil, which is a much larger, more economically significant country. I was like, I didn't really know about what had gone on there. The crimes were maybe not quite as vast, but still, they were still doing the same shit. Let's be clear, the father in the movie is, running information for the left wing rebels, right? He's not like an armed combatant against the government, but he's definitely part of the opposition, and he and his friends who are sort of they're revolutionaries in their own quiet way. So it's not like he isn't doing anything, but it certainly isn't doing anything that warrants his murder.
Yeah, it's pretty severe.
maybe a stern letter, or just arrested and subjected to a civil trial or something. You can see it, but he's basically disappeared and then dumped in the ocean.
Right, and it clearly, if they're reaching out to people like him, then it's very much about spreading fear, just as much as getting the people who are actually trafficking.
Yeah, they're trying to shut down. They're trying to shut down dissent. This wasn't a democratic society. Right. And so, it's a very visceral and realistic evocation of what life under that world is like. Because there's lots of people you're walking around, just going to the beach and going out for ice cream, who aren't involved in the revolution and whose families aren't being disappeared. And there's that beautiful scene in the ice cream parlor where Fernanda Torres takes her kids out after she finds out her husband has been killed. And she looks at all the happy families around her.
Yeah, and what's interesting too is, especially after they've all been tortured and everything, and the press takes a picture of the family and, they say,
look more serious.
Yeah, look more serious. And she's like, why? And he's like, because it's a very serious thing. And she's like, no, we're going to smile. We're a happy family. Not a happy family, but we're a resilient family.
They're a resilient family. And, and I will say too, most of the film takes place in the 70s, just beautiful performances by the children.
Yeah. And they all have different aspects too. There's that one, the teenage girl is going off to London, right? So they all have their own lives and their own stuff going on.
Yeah, she's off to London to walk on Abbey Road, and and then there's the son. There's only one son. There's four daughters who is destined to become a novelist in a wheelchair, mind you.
In a wheelchair, yeah.
Who suffers some kind of terrible accident, which we don't see, which the movie does not show, and you just kind of have to be like, oh, I saw poor Marcelo. Anyway, look, this is a good movie. This is a really good movie, and it's nice to see a movie like this get the attention. it's getting, and I think it's resonating with audiences. It's a great movie, and Stephen Garrett is heavily compromised when it comes to discussing this movie. And yet somehow you managed to discuss it just like you discuss every other movie with me. How did you do that? What's your secret, Stephen?
I'm not very critical.
If you're critical of this movie, then truly, you are a troll. Stephen Garrett, you are still here, and you're going to be here for the rest of your life. And I'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks.
When you're with the perfect guy, you're just waiting for him to say those three little words.
You're a robot.
You're joking. The days of you controlling me are over.
Shut her down already.
One of my favorite movies so far in 2025 is called Companion. I would liken it to being, it's sort of like a 97-minute Black Mirror episode with perhaps slightly more graphic violence. And I went to this movie, you know, the trailers they were showing at the Alamo Drafthouse didn't really give me much to go on. I went to this movie not knowing exactly what I was going to see. And I just ended up loving this thing. It's basically a film about a sex robot who gets caught up in a scheme to murder someone, for lack of a better description. And who better than to talk about sex robots murdering people than Pablo Gallaga? Also, I knew that Pablo would have seen this movie and would have some interesting thoughts about Companion. So hello, Pablo.
Thanks for that intro, Neil. That's awesome.
Yes. You're not a robot, right? You might be. Well, you might be.
I might be. How would I know? That's the thing.
You wouldn't.
I wouldn't.
It's part of your programming to not know. So I don't know. I just loved this movie. It was just so fun and thrilling and, you know, a little sexy in its own way and really well acted and tense. And, you know, and I put in my review on Book and Film Globe, my 4-star review, surprisingly, of Companion, I put this in a genre of like kind of Black Mirror style movies, right? Like you have this, you had Megan. I would put Barbarian in that list because it's sort of a satire of Airbnb. Bodies, 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 Heretic. You know, there's all these movies that have been these genre movies that, you know, really are having a lot of fun with satirizing modern life and technology and sort of modern obsessions. Would you agree with that classification?
Yeah, I don't want to reduce it, but it's basically horror comedy ex machina. So it's not that sort of like, you know, it gets into the ideas of the technology and how it would affect humanity, but it's having fun with it. In, you know, sometimes Black Mirror does that where it goes straight horror comedy, and sometimes it's in that very like procedural sort of vein. This one is much more of the comedy, and you know what you're getting because it's from the producer of the director who did Barbarian.
Yeah, Zach Cregger. He did not direct this. This was directed by, I believe his name was Drew Hancock, who's a writer for Jimmy Kimmel. If I'm not mistaken, I think I was reading up on it.
He's done a lot of television. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was My Dead Ex is the TV series he's most known for.
And yeah, so this is not Ex Machina, is Danny Boyle, right?
Alex Garland.
Alex Garland. Okay. So, you know, he tends to have a pretty heavy hand, right? I mean, Ex Machina is a great movie, but it's not fun like Companion is. I mean, Companion is just nonstop fun. I just enjoyed every moment of this, from the sort of meet cute at the beginning to the satisfying sort of musical montage at the end. I just thought, you know, it didn't waste a lot of time.
Yeah, it knows what it's doing. It knows, you know, where the laughs are. Like that extended dance number at the end. Oh gosh, that killed me, and it killed my whole crowd too.
The dance number, the thing with the where Iris kind of turns on her German language function. Very funny.
Yeah, and I mean, I know that that's post-production stuff, but we got to talk about Sophie Thatcher. I knew this was going to be, like, I think her role in Heretic was breakout, but this is the role. I think this is the one where people are going to start to see her in that light. I've been saying she's the next Anya Taylor-Joy.
She was great. Sophie Thatcher was legit. I can't even think of who else could have played this role. She was so great. She just owned it so totally. And she's had a lot. I felt like she had a lot of range, right? Like, because this part of Iris like forces her to play dumb, play really dumb, play really smart, like a wide range of emotions.
Yeah, murderous, cute, like everything. She runs the full gamut.
Yeah.
Yeah. Recently, she's been, like we say, in Heretic. She was in The Boogeyman, which she was also great in. But
yeah.
So far, nothing has really given her the opportunity to show the range. Maybe Yellow Jackets kind of does, but even that kind of boxes her in a little bit. But no, this is the one where you get to see everything she can do.
Yeah. And I don't think Companion is not going to be a massive hit movie in its own right, right? Like, it's not going to make hundreds of millions of dollars. It's a genre film, and it's designed to land in the sort of the high double digits at best, like these movies are supposed to do, in the double digits in the millions. But what it is going to do is provide a showcase for Hollywood to show exactly who this is and what she can do. And on conversely, I would say that, you know, I guess I'm spoiling things, but so what, you know, at this point, like there's another robot character in the movie and that he is played by Lucas Gage, who is also, I think, really good in this movie.
Surprisingly so. I mean, he's, you know, he's good, but they give him a lot to do in this one as well. And I'm very proud of myself for how quickly I spotted that twist that was coming.
Yeah.
I think there's some mention of something about how companions can't lie to each other. I'm like, why would you even mention that?
He was also just an incredibly good cook.
Yeah, yeah. Incredibly attractive too for, you know, no offense to Harvey Guillen, but I don't know if Harvey Guillen could pull Lucas Gage. Like that was just, you know, there's the disparity between Jack Quaid and Sophie Thatcher, disparity between Harvey Guillen and Lucas Gage. And that was pretty obvious.
The disparity between Jack Quaid and Sophie Thatcher is only wide because
acting
Jack
ability Quaid's,
well, acting, yeah, Jack Quaid is, I kind of was noticing in this movie, like he's kind of a one trick pony, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of schlubby, loserish guy that kind of has a little bit of gross charm to him.
Kind of, he was kind of indistinguishable in this from his Huey Jennings character in The Boys. Not to say he was bad in this, because he was fine. He did everything he was supposed to do. But, you know, he couldn't hold a candle. Well, he could hold a candle to Sophie Thatcher. Yeah. So I don't know. Like, I just think this is like my favorite genre of movies right now. You know, I don't like horror, right?
Right. We've talked about this before where it just seems like the genre is headed more towards fun. Like we had that sort of trauma trend for a while and, you know, how people deal with things that they've been through. And no, this is more just like, let's have a good time. Let's see some gore. Let's do some stuff that makes people happy and it's fun.
But it's also like a light satire of, it's a light satire of gender relations. It is a light satire of technology. Just like Black Mirror does, you know, and I feel like those other movies I mentioned, well, Heretic wasn't so much about technology, except that when those girls lost their Wi-Fi in Hugh Grant's house, their goose was cooked, you know? So it's there a little bit.
I think Megan is probably the closest analog. Barbarian, I put Barbarian above this one because that one's just so bonkers and you don't know what's going to happen next. And it has the same sort of comedic element to it. Like Justin Long has that great performance in it. But yeah, like the technology commentary, I think you have to look at something like Megan. The last Chucky movie also kind of did a bit of this with like smart home technology.
And again, though, I feel like, you know, and I keep bringing Bodies, Bodies, Bodies up, but there that the entire thing on Bodies, Bodies, Bodies hinges on a cell phone recording that they don't see.
Right.
And it all these are also movies about, I mean, I guess these are Gen Z characters, right? Like Sophie Thatcher's 25, the actor's 25, Jack Quaid, you know, can't be, is you know, 30 at the oldest. And so like, this is a vicious satire of Gen Z gender relations.
Yeah, and it's just also subverting some expectations in the genre itself. Yeah, like the comedic stuff comes in at the perfect moments in this film where it just kind of, it keeps the momentum still going for what's happening and like the more, you know, bloody elements of the story, but it's doing something that I think that needs to happen in the genre so we can get away from just things being so dark.
So dark and so dreary and so trauma-based. Like this is the opposite of trauma porn, right? Like you leave a movie like this. I left this movie feeling good.
It's a good time all around. And it really is buoyed by that performance by Sophie Thatcher. Like you feel like you can do anything after you watch what she does.
Yeah, she's amazing. She's amazing in this. And it's not just because she is, you know, beautiful, and which she is, you know, obviously, but like it's also just like just an incredible performance.
You empathize with her the whole way.
Yeah, it is a true star-making vehicle if I've ever seen one. I'd be surprised if your prediction from earlier in our conversation doesn't come true. Like, she's going to be huge.
She will.
And so will you, Pablo. So will I. We're all gonna be big because just by
huge
liking
robots. We're all gonna be robots. It's gonna turn out we're robots.
Yeah, well, there would be worse fates. My intelligence is definitely turned up to 100. Or like 95. Let's say 95. 93.
Can you play with your voice in post production? Let's see.
I can definitely have the engineer like take my voice up and down in pitch. Let's see how he does. All right. Thank you so much, Pablo Goyaga. I will talk to you soon.
Thanks, Neil.
The four of you together again. Wow. I'm tightening the leash.
You okay?
I gotta get us out of here.
The TV show of the moment among people like me who like to declare things TV shows of the moment is Severance, the Apple TV Plus show that had its first season 3 years ago and was sort of a sleeper hit and then went away for a while and has come back and is no longer a sleeper hit. I would say that Severance is now has entered the mainstream and season two has they've run as we're talking four episodes and there's no letdown at all. In fact, I would say that season two is in fact even a little bit better than season one. It's sort of adding to the myth and the lore. And I have a local Severance expert, Scott Gold, is here to talk to me about the second season of Severance. Hello, Scott.
Hi, this is Scott's innie, and I'm happy to be here.
So I'm talking to Scott G then.
Yes, this is Scott G.
Not so you don't know anything about what you're like on the outside.
I hear my Audi is kind to children.
Kind to children and loves a good meal.
Yes.
Obviously, like if you haven't watched Severance, you don't know what the hell Scott and I are talking about. But if you have, then you do. And you know that it's a show about, it's sort of in its initial setup, it's a show about a corporation called the Lumon Corporation, L-U-M-O-N, that has developed some sort of technology that allows people to sever their day-to-day personalities as they descend into the pits of the corporate offices and they do some sort of unnamed corporate work, but it's like a different, they're like a different person. They have the same physiology, but they're a different person. They have none of them. They don't have any memory of who they actually are in real life. Would you say that's pretty accurate? That's accurate, right?
Yes, it's totally accurate. And I think it just barely scratches the surface of what Severance is really about. And
that's like episode one.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, it's hard enough just to get your mind around, you know, the idea of, you know, what it would be like to have, you know, your brain severed into two people, one who goes to work all the time. And that's all they do. Like you live your life and you go into an elevator and then, you know, a split second later, you're going down the elevator at the end of the day. And that sounds to most people like pretty great. Like I don't have to worry about work, except if you're the quote, innie. The person who's at work, you never get a day off. You're just at work doing work all the time. That's all you know. And of course, the innies decide that, you know, maybe that isn't the best way to live. And, you know, a big part of the culmination of season one, and spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't watched Severance yet, is that the innies kind of stage their small scale revolution, at least in the macro data refinement department. Which consists of our four protagonists.
Yeah, played by Adam Scott and John Turturro, and then they're the best known actors, and then Zach Cherry and Britt Haller are the other two. And they're all terrific in these parts, you know, iconically so in some ways. Like, this is a show that, like, it has entered iconography territory. You know, but part of the problem, too, is that Lumon Corporation is just so deeply weird in so many ways.
Oh, yeah. Like, we don't even know what Lumon does or like what their goal is or what kind of services they provide. But clearly like they are a tremendously successful and wealthy corporation. They actually own the town that the Audis live in. And we don't even know if it's actually in the United States. Like if you want to go down fan theory rabbit holes, one of the best things about Severance is they are viciously deep and really insane. People speculating about.
I thought it was in Pennsylvania. No,
it's Keir P. I think it's P E. and not PA. So nobody knows what the state PE is. So there's a lot of speculation there, but it's clearly somewhere very cold. But also it doesn't really appear to be in like modern United States, because all the cars are kind of weirdly like dated, and it seems like it might be in like a weird separate universe. But that aside, Lumen is a corporation. The more we learn about it, the weirder and weirder it gets. And we got some really amazing, like very Lynchian moments in season one. And we get even more of them in season two, where you're just scratching your head being like, what is happening? And the great part is the characters are saying the same thing because they're equally clueless. They're like, what is that? Like, what is happening? What's going on? And so the unraveling of all that, hopefully it'll pay off. And it's not like a Lost situation where you have this really amazing, profoundly weird, gripping, dramatic story that has no payoff at the end.
Right. So what I'm thinking about Severance is it could go one of two directions. It could go the Lost direction and just get caught up. And like shows, there's a lot of shows like Lost that establish these really cool mythologies and then lose track of them and don't know where they're going. Or it could go the Twin Peaks direction, which is to provide just an incredible payoff and a deeply satisfying, you know, intellectual, emotional, and aesthetic experience while also still being funny, because that's the thing. You know, Severance is, I would not call it a comedy, but it has, there's a lot of funny stuff in it. There's a lot of cool, absurdist, hilarious office satire.
Oh, absolutely. And it's often an uncomfortable humor. Like there's a great scene with a wonderful cameo by Gwendolyn Christie, of course, of Game of Thrones fame and also Captain Phasma in Star Wars. And, the macro data refiners in season two are given a little bit of a longer leash to kind of explore the Lumen building a little bit. And they're finding themselves in some very strange places, one of which is it kind of looks like the Microsoft Office desktop crossed with like Teletubby land. It's like it's a weirdly stark white office space with a big lush green hill in it. And there are people tending goats.
It's like a goat farm in the middle of the office.
Right. And then comes Gwendolyn Christie, who leaps to the top of the hill and asks, are you here to kill me? And it's just like it's so unsettling and unexpected and hilarious and wonderful. It's just unique and creative in a way that we're not getting a lot of in television these days. That is actually genuinely intelligent and really well done. It's just, it's such a delight. And I really just have to give credit to Ben Stiller, who has 100% come into his own as a director. And I think people are going to look back on the show and look at the arc of Ben Stiller's career and say, hey, like he's really turned a corner here, because this is just magnificent work. Not to mention the cinematography is absolutely stunning. At the beginning, the first season of episode two, we get this amazing tracking shot of Adam Scott's character running around the office with no cuts. And the camera's kind of panning around and zipping around and going in and out to the point where you're just like, you know, how are they doing this? Clearly, like it's a combination of cinematography and CGI, but it's so seamless and kind of weird and unsettling. Not to mention the title sequence is one of the best I've seen in a long time. It's just
the new one, the season two title sequence.
The new one, yeah. Oh, it's like an acid trip. Yeah. It's so freaky.
Yeah, which is what the show is like, honestly. Like you never really know what reality you're dealing with. And, you know, also like, you know, it has the single best cast on TV right now where, they have Christopher Walken, which is like kind of on the bench. You know, Rosanna Arquette just hanging out in the background as a side character.
That's Patricia Arquette, not Rosanna.
Patricia Arquette, duh.
Who was great in Ben Stiller's other project about Escape from Dannemora.
Yeah.
And she's pretty much great in everything she does. And she is one of my favorite characters in the show because her character is thoroughly unhinged. And we're not getting a lot of her in the first four episodes. I'm only guessing that we're going to get a lot more going forward. But real star turns by the major cast, like Britt Lower as Helly R.
Yeah, and she's like was not well known before the show. She is fantastic, and you know, and then Adam Scott and John Turturro.
Yeah, and Zach Cherry, mostly comic relief, but also we knew him as like the guy in the Spider-Man movie said, "Hey, Spider-Man, do a flip." And that's how he came on the scene. And now, like, this is a really deep role, and I love to see actors like him, you know, have something like this. And it's just really great. So, you know, Trammell Tillman, another just huge standout, just doing a really amazing
Trammell
job.
Tillman is Mr. Milchick, right?
That's right. He's an African-American man whose name is Seth Milchick, which is also, you know, disorienting because that does not sound like a black guy's name. But
Mr. Milchick. First of all, no one has cooler clothes on TV than Mr. Milchick.
Oh, my God. He is so suave.
His look is just incredible. And the best mustache on TV since Gordon from Left Sesame Street. You know, it is just like, he is just the coolest. He's just a very mysterious character and just the coolest guy. There's just so much to talk about with Severance that I don't think I can even begin to scratch the surface of it. But I will say that I find that there is generally a 10-minute nap somewhere in every episode for me. And I find that I can kind of fade in and out of it. Maybe my Audi is taking a nap while my innie is watching the show.
Yeah, I have no idea what you're talking about because every episode has me 100% glued. Even in the softer moments when there's not a lot of dialogue, like the acting is so brilliant that just a look, like a lingering look. And also, you know, again, props to Britt Lower in her performance. And I'm not sure going to try and spoil too much, but, you know, she's like, in the Robert Downey Jr. way, she's a person playing a person, pretending to be a person. She's like playing like three or four different roles in the same person in like one scene. And you can kind of see where it is just in her facial expressions and what they're going through. It's just really, really remarkable. And I just love the weirdness of it. Like, again, like very Lynchian, very dreamlike. But still, it's its own thing. There's no other show that looks like this, that behaves like this, that's really like it yet. And I think it's going to be one of the standout shows of this decade.
I agree. Or that's written like it. It's just kind of a singular piece of work. And it can't really be duplicated. It's just so its own thing. Don't get me wrong. The nap is not a disparaging thing. Like, I often find myself... Look, I love David Lynch a lot. And I often found myself napping during Lynch. Sometimes my brain just overloads and short circuits, you know?
Yeah, there's only so much weirdness you can process.
Yeah, which exactly. Is great,
you know, each episode is only, you know, like 50 minutes or whatever. And also, I do love the fact that we're getting one episode a week and not a giant season content dump, because I think that would definitely overload my brain. And also, it gives the fans space for water cooler talk. And again, like, I think this is such a great water cooler show. I mean, I know that's a like hilariously archaic term, but I'm running with it. And it's just one of those things that, you know, I watch an episode and then I'm like, I'm on Reddit and I'm on social media, like digging into fan theories and catching little things.
It's a virtual water cooler, but that's what William Schwartz wrote about it for us on Book and Film Globe. And that's what he said, is that there's a value to having, especially with a show like this, to having one episode every week, and it allows them to have genuine cliffhangers and not just like some shows do, that they just stop in the middle of a scene and then the next episode immediately restarts and you're in the middle of that scene again. You know, this show has like genuine starting and stopping points, and every episode leaves you with a sort of this lingering sense of weird dread.
Absolutely. Yeah. That sense of like, but like corporate dread, which is a very special kind of dread that I think a lot of us have experienced if you've worked for a big company with like a lot of cubicles and like a weirdly like different corporate culture. The last thing I want to add, I want to make sure that I get this in before we wrap up, is first of all, John Turturro just keeps getting better and better with every performance. And this is such a great character for him. And there was definitely, I don't know if anybody else caught this, but there was definitely a little bit of a nod in episode 4 to his character in Miller's Crossing, who had a scene in the woods that was, you know, very memorable. And I felt like that was an intentional callback by Ben Stiller and the writers. That was great. And I think he's just absolutely magnificent in this role. It's remarkable. And I just absolutely adore this show. And my only fear is that it doesn't pay off as much as I'm hoping it will. But even if it doesn't, I think it's going to be a great ride.
I think that if they keep it to three seasons-ish, and assuming they actually know what they're doing.
Yeah,
that was exactly. Always the problem with shows like Lost and shows that were worse than Lost is that in the end, you're like, well, wait, they didn't really know what they were doing. And so we just have to hope that the people who do Severance, they seem to know what they're doing. I agree, though. It is the show of the moment. And, you know, it's just interesting that it's kind of hiding out on Apple TV, right? That is a network, a streaming service that is not something that everyone has.
True.
It's the kind of thing that used to be, maybe HBO used to do. It's the smart show for the smart people.
Well, I'm watching it, so it must be for smart people.
Well, your Audi is very smart, Scott.
Oh, is he? Ah. Maybe one day I'll get to meet him.
No, you're never going to get to meet him. That is forbidden. All right, Scott G, thank you so much. I will talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me back, Dale.
All right, thank you so much, Scott Gold, Severance Season 2, now airing on Apple TV+, the best TV network that none of you have. Companion is in theaters at the moment, but will probably be on streaming soon. Pablo Gallego is here to talk to me about it. And also thank you to Stephen Garrett for talking to me about the Brazilian Oscar-contending film I'm Still Here, which is in theaters now and is doing quite well. And that's always very gratifying to see a movie that good finding an audience. I am Neil Pollack. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We are a product of Sea of Reeds Media. Sea of Reeds Media owns two independent bookstores in New Jersey, the Bookhouse in Millburn and the Bookhouse in Long Branch. If you happen to be in the area, please stop by or establish those bookstores as your home bookstores on bookshop.org. We get a little percentage of every sale if you do that, and we sure would appreciate it. That's all for now. I'm Neil Pollack. I'm still here. I'll be here next week too, and I'll talk to you then.
The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.